Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Charles Hayden Planetarium. How's everybody doing? Oh, good. That's good to hear. My name's Noreen. I work here in the planetarium, and I'll be presenting our afternoon program. It's called Astronomy in Cambridge. It's a special presentation as part of the Cambridge Science Festival that's happening this week in Cambridge. We're going to be talking about some of the objects that you can see from the night sky in Cambridge, and also some of the different astronomical research which is happening in the area. Well, as you can see, we're beginning our journey of the night sky at Harvard Square. You're now standing or sitting right in the center of Harvard Square. I've put some red letters on the wall so you know our directions. Behind me is the red N for north. We've got the red E for east, the red S for south, and the red W for west. And we have the sun very low into the western sky. So what I'm going to do is to let our sun set down so we can look for some changes that happen in the sky overhead and in the buildings of Boston. And now that the sun is set down from Cambridge, we can begin to see some of the bright stars and other objects from our night sky. If you were watching carefully, you might have noticed there were two stars that were visible before all the others. Did anyone notice the first star? Do you know, what direction did you see it at? Over in the west, that's right. The first object that you might have noticed is a very bright white star. It's actually the planet Venus. So you can see Venus very prominently in the direction where the sun set down. And moving over toward the east, almost a straight line over toward the east, we come to a yellowish star. If I told you that is the planet that has the most rings, do you know what planet it is? It's Saturn. So we can see the planets Venus and Saturn in the early evening sky. Now, about a 10-minute walk from where we are right now, up 60 Garden Street, would take you to one of the astronomical research centers in Cambridge, and that is the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. An astronomer at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics studies planets, but not the planets of our solar system. He studies planets beyond our solar system that are orbiting other stars. We call those exoplanets. Now, if you've never been to the Center for Astrophysics, it really is just a 10-minute walk from Harvard Square. This is an exterior view. And on the third Thursday of every month, they have a free public lecture on different astronomical topics, followed by observing with the Great Refractor, if weather permits. So that's a destination you might want to put on your calendar. But going back to the planets, Dr. David Charbonneau is an astronomer at the Center for Astrophysics. He uses a group of automated telescopes in California at the Mount Palomar Observatory, in Arizona at the Lowell Observatory, and in Spain at the Canary Islands to search for exoplanets. He uses a group of telescopes that he calls TRACE, the Transatlantic Exoplanet Survey. Dr. Charbonneau and his colleagues discovered a planet around a star in the constellation of Lyra. Now, here's how that works. He studies the light of a star, and if the planet actually eclipses or transits the star, at a certain point it will pass in front and then behind the star. When that happens, there's about a 2% light loss or diminishing light from that star. And if you make a graph of that, that's actually called a light curve, you follow the light of the star and planet together, and then there is a decrease in light when the star is gone behind, when the star is in front of the planet's gone behind the star. And then the light returns when both objects are visible. So by studying the light of the star and planet, you can deduce that there is a planet there. And it's amazing when you think about how distant stars are and how small they appear, even through a telescope, and to think that a planet may have 1/1,000,000th of the light of the star, and you can still detect it. So Dr. Charbonneau has studied this planet, and he's determined that the planet orbits its star every 3 days from a distance of only 4 million miles from its star. And in comparison, Mercury is 36 million miles from the Sun and takes 88 days to travel one time around the Sun. So this is a very fast-moving planet. And this planet is about 1,500 degrees hot, and it is a type of planet that is called a hot Jupiter. It is as big as Jupiter, but very hot. So if you ever hear that term, hot Jupiter, it's referring to a very large planet orbiting another star. Okay, so that's something to think about when you're looking at planets, thinking about planets around other stars. Now, one of the things that's very difficult to do is actually see the stars from Harvard Square, and you can probably guess why. A lot of lights. This is a problem, it's called light pollution, and if you think about the lights coming out of windows and these street lights and signs and automobiles, all these lights are making the sky look very bright. It's very hard to see the stars. So how about we create an imaginary power failure? Would you like to see more stars than this? Let's turn off the lights in Cambridge. I'm going to show you what the sky can really look like. So it's time to get rid of all these lights. Well, that looked a little better. It's amazing. You're looking at about 6,000 stars right now, but before, you could only see about 50 stars. And all these stars were shining, but the city lights made them very difficult to see. So I'm going to let you take a moment for your eyes to become sensitive to the darkness as you scan around the sky and notice some of these new objects. Now, if you're not familiar with looking at a sky like this, this might seem a little overwhelming, but I'm going to show you that things are just where we left them. Remember, we were looking at the planet Venus, high in the west. And do you remember the name of this planet? It was Saturn, right over in high in the southeast. Okay, let's take a look at some other things. Between Saturn and Venus, we can find the three stars in a row that mark the starry belt of Orion the Hunter. And Orion is a symbol of the winter time. We've been looking at Orion all winter long, and he's supposed to be a great hunter in the sky, but finally, we are past winter, finally. And he is setting down a little bit earlier each day. So here's what he might look like. Here's our imaginary view of Orion the Hunter. Okay. Now, if you look very carefully, as your eyes are becoming sensitive, look very carefully and follow along where I'm tracing, you might notice this part of the sky is just a little bit brighter than the rest. Right? Do you know what we call this? The Milky Way. That's right. So what exactly is the Milky Way? It's our galaxy, right? This is our galaxy. And we can't see what our galaxy looks like from the outside because we live inside. All the stars we see at night, these are stars in our galaxy. And if we want to learn about other galaxies, we have to take their pictures. And that's what we've done. We can look at a neighboring galaxy that's called Andromeda. Andromeda is a spiral galaxy. It's a pinwheel of stars with a very similar shape like the Milky Way. But we think that the Andromeda galaxy is a little bit bigger than the Milky Way. Now, when you're looking up at the night sky and you're seeing stars, about 6,000 from a very dark location, that's really a small amount of stars in the Milky Way, because some people think our Milky Way has about 400 billion stars, and our Sun is just one of them. So we can learn about galaxies by looking at other galaxies. You'll notice the Andromeda is very bright in the middle. We don't live in the middle of the Milky Way. We live actually toward the edge of one of the pinwheel arms. And the galaxy is flat. It's kind of flat like a Frisbee. So when we look up in the sky from a very dark location, we see a glowing band of light arcing across the sky. That's the thickest part of our galaxy. Okay? Now, let's take a look at the Big Dipper. Do you know how to find the Big Dipper? Okay. The Big Dipper is shaped like what? A spoon, right, a big spoon. Okay, if I told you right now the Big Dipper is between the Red N and the Red E, it's in the northeastern part of the sky, can you find it? Good. It's right over here. And we can take a look at the individual stars. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. These four stars mark the spoon part, and these three stars mark the handle. Okay, right above the handle, right where I'm circling, what do you see? What's right here? Nothing. Can you look around the sky and see places where there's nothing? Okay, I want to show you this particular area where there's nothing. The Hubble Space Telescope, which is a telescope in space orbiting us about 360 miles in Earth orbit, took a picture of that area, and here's what it looks like. It turns out there are thousands of galaxies in this particular part of the sky, and we didn't know about them before because we couldn't see them. They're very far away and they're very faint, and it took a telescope in space to be able to see these galaxies. So when you look around the sky and you see places that look fairly empty, they might not be empty, they just might have objects which are very difficult to see from the surface of the Earth. Now, there's an astronomer at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics that studies galaxies, and her name is Dr. Margaret Geller. Dr. Geller is a pioneer in mapping the locations of galaxies in the near universe, so some of the closest galaxies to us, she has been able to observe and map. I want to show you one of her early maps here. Okay, this is sort of a slice of the universe, and every little dot you see is the location of a galaxy, which has been plotted on this map. Now, when she started making these maps, which was almost about 20 years ago, there was a figure that appeared. It kind of looked like a stick man. In fact, she called it the stick man, and she was trying to figure out what exactly does that represent? Is there some kind of a special pattern in space? So she continued her exploration and she was mapping additional galaxies. Here's another version of her map. All of a sudden the stick figures disappeared, but we've got a lot more galaxies. She has continued to map these galaxies with her colleagues, and we are really getting an incredible map. Dr. Geller is trying to understand the structure of the universe. We don't know completely what the universe is like. It's something we're still learning about. It's something that we're still exploring. But that's a little about what Dr. Geller does at Harvard. Okay, I'd like to point out if there's any need, we do have those two exits clearly marked in the planetarium if anyone has to leave for any reason during the program. Okay, let's go back to the Big Dipper. We can use the Big Dipper to find a very important star. Do you know what star that is? The North Star, right. So guess what direction we're going to look to find the North Star? In the north. And there are a lot of stars in the north, quite a few stars. So the way to know the North Star is by following the Big Dipper. We'll go to the end of the handle, follow it all the way until we reach the two stars in the very front of the spoon. These two stars here are called the pointer stars. And then you just do connect the dots. You go from the bottom star to the top star and you keep your line going. And the next star you get to, guess what? It's the North Star, which happens to be the end of the handle of the Little Dipper. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So there's our Little Dipper right there. Okay. Now, Let's take a look at another pattern. This one is next to Saturn. It kind of looks like a backward question mark. Some people think it looks like a coat hanger. Yeah. It is the head and mane of Leo the lion. Now, Leo is the symbol of spring. And when Leo prowls high in the sky, he brings warm weather. I don't know if he's been doing a very good job this winter, because winter seemed to last until just a few days ago, and then it suddenly turned off. But Leo the lion is sort of staring at Saturn right now. And above Leo, the Big Dipper is part of a pattern, a large pattern called Ursa Major, the Sky Bear. And you see that the Dipper is right inside that bear. So the Dipper is a star pattern, and the bear is the entire constellation. Now, these are some of the imaginary figures that you might think about in the early evening sky. But I want to go back to the North Star for a moment. The North Star, well, is it the brightest star? No, which means it must be important for a different reason. It does something that no other star does. I'm going to let time go by a little bit. And as I do, we're going to notice the stars are drifting. It looks like the sky is rotating. Stars are rising up from the east and setting down toward the west. This is just the Earth turning. And the Big Dipper's moving too, but it always points to the North Star. What's the North Star doing? It's doing something no other star is doing. It's staying put. The North Star is a reflection of the Earth's North Pole in the sky. It's the only star that doesn't move. It's almost like it's a thumbtack and the sky is rotating around it. So you can use the Big Dipper to find the North Star, and you can see the North Star as long as you are north of the equator. Right, so anywhere on Earth, as long as you are north of the equator, you will be able to see the North Star. Okay, I'm going to let the sky move a little bit more, and I'm going to bring up some of the other star patterns. And I want to now move on toward another research center in Cambridge. This research center is just about a 10-minute walk from where we are, and it's the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. Now, at MIT, let's see, the campus is really just along the Charles River here, most of it. And at MIT, there is another astronomer who searches for exoplanets, those planets around other stars. Her name is Dr. Sarah Seeger. Dr. Seeger is a planetary scientist who, like Dr. Charbonneau, studies hot Jupiters, and she was part of a team that observed an exoplanet called HD209458b. Now that sounds like a lot of letters and numbers there. HD means it's a star in the Henry Draper catalog. That's HD. And it's in the constellation of Pegasus. According to her team, this planet is also a hot Jupiter. It orbits its star every 3.5 days, and the planet is about 904 trillion miles from the Earth. Very far away, but something that we can still observe. So we've got other searches for exoplanets happening in MIT. If you have a good telescope and you know where to look, you can observe another class of objects, and these are asteroids, which are rocky objects smaller than the moon. Most of the asteroids in our solar system are found in the asteroid belt, which is between the orbits of Earth and Mars. But actually, there are some asteroids that cross Earth's orbit. Those are called Earth-approaching asteroids, and those are the ones that people always get worried about, because you might hear on the radio or TV, oh, an asteroid has been discovered, and you know, will it come crashing toward the Earth? Well, there's a scientist at MIT who is an expert on asteroids. His name is Dr. Richard Binzel. He's an expert, and he developed the Torino scale, which is a way of describing the impact hazard of asteroids. So instead of just saying, oh, there's an asteroid very close by, he made the scale so you could say this asteroid has a Torino orbit of zero, so everybody would know no danger. Or on the other hand, this asteroid has a Torino scale of 10, which is not good, because then that would mean a very likely collision. There are no asteroids that we know of that have a Torino scale of 10, so we've not discovered anything that's coming en route to the Earth, but at least we have a way to describe these asteroid orbits. Dr. Binzel is also a staff scientist on the New Horizons mission to Pluto. Did you all follow the story last summer about Pluto and its planetary status? You know, there's a new word in the dictionary. It's called plutoed. It means to be demoted. So Pluto was plutoed and put into a different category. Because it's so small, it was put into a category called dwarf planets. So now we've got 8 classical planets, and then we've got a category of dwarf planets where Pluto is the largest. But whatever you call Pluto, there's a probe on its way there. It was launched last year, and it's going to arrive in the year 2015. It's not going to land on Pluto. It's a flyby mission. This probe is going to be taking images of Pluto and its moons for 6 months. And then it's going to continue out toward a place called the Kuiper Belt, which is kind of like a second asteroid belt that begins near Pluto. And it's going to be taking pictures of those icy objects, and it may be sending back information for 20 years. So it's really a very exciting mission. We're going to hear a lot more about it. This probe has already passed the orbit of Jupiter, and it's on its way out to Pluto. So that's some very exciting research happening at MIT. Now, as we observe the night sky on a clear night from a very dark location, you can see thousands of stars, but are we seeing all there is? Well, about 1 mile from where we are right now in Kendall Square is a center that controls the Chandra X-ray Observatory. The control center is in Kendall Square. And it's really amazing because this is a space telescope like Hubble, but it orbits very far out, goes about a third of the way out to the moon. It was named after an astrophysicist, Dr. Chandra Sekhar. He was a pioneer on the structure and evolution of stars. He really was trying to understand what stars were made of and what the life and death cycle of stars were. So this telescope was named in his honor. It was deployed by the Space Shuttle Columbia in July 1999, and it orbits the Earth every 64 hours in a very long path that does take it about a third of the way out to the moon. So if there was ever a mechanical problem with this telescope, we could not send astronauts to fix it. Its orbit is beyond the reach of astronauts in the space shuttle. Now, when Chandra takes a picture or receives data from an object, what happens is the data is then transferred from Chandra down to a group of radio telescopes called the Deep Space Network. Then that information is transferred to the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena and then right on to the Chandra Control Center in Kendall Square. And then they can adjust the telescope to take other pictures. So it's really amazing that the control center is right here. Well, why would we need to launch another telescope in space? Because we already have the Hubble telescope. You've probably one time or another held up a prism to sunlight and noticed that the sunlight can be broken up into colors of the rainbow. We call that the spectrum, with red at one end and blue at the other. Now, the colors of the rainbow are what we see in visible light, but visible light is not the only kind of light there is. There are other kinds of light that you've probably heard of. They just have different names, like gamma rays and x-rays, ultraviolet, infrared, microwave, and radio. These are all different kinds of light, but human eyes are not able to detect these kinds of light. Well, not only are there different kinds of light, but the Earth's atmosphere is protecting us and preventing us from seeing the different kinds of light. See, radio waves will make it all the way through the Earth's atmosphere down to the surface. And infrared, if you could go at high altitudes, you might be able to observe it, or launch a weather balloon, something like that. Visible light will go down to the surface, but we're hampered by the weather. Then we've got ultraviolet and X-rays and gamma rays, and our atmosphere is just protecting us from all these things. So if we need to observe them, we need to go above the Earth's atmosphere. Let me give you an example of the power of seeing another wavelength. You've probably heard of the mathematician Johann Kepler. In 1604, he observed a bright star in the sky that had never been seen before. The star was a supernova. It was the final stage of a supermassive star's life. Kepler was probably not the first person to view the supernova, but he did carefully observe it for a year. And then after, when the star faded away from view, he published a book about it. Nowadays, we can't see that star, but we see what's left. That's the supernova remnant, and we call it the Kepler supernova remnant. I'm going to show you some different pictures of that same object. First of all, here's a picture of the Kepler remnant as taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. So you just see a sort of a yellowish, irregular blob, okay? Now, the same picture with the Spitzer Infrared Telescope. This is the same object, and what you're looking at are the dark, warm particles in space that are not visible to Hubble. Now, the very same picture through the Chandra eyes. These are high-energy particles that you can see in X-ray vision, and if we combined all three views, we would know what the object really look like. See, so without all these different views, all we would get was just a little irregular blob. So multi-wavelength astronomy allows us to see much further. Let me point out that the Big Dipper has now moved over to the northwest. And low in the northeast, we've got a pattern that looks like the letter W. Got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 stars. Anyone know this constellation? Cassiopeia, right. Cassiopeia was the ancient queen of Ethiopia. And here she is with her husband, King Cepheus, the king of Ethiopia. Well, there is another object that was seen in that part of the sky around 1680, the Cassiopeia A supernova remnant. And here are combined views. We've got in the blue box on the right, the optical view. Below it, we've got the infrared view. To its left, we've got the radio view. And above, we've got the X-ray view. So again, viewing this object with different wavelengths allows us to get a really good sense of the structure of this object. So the Chandra X-ray telescope really helps us in that way. When we combine it with the Hubble Space Telescope, and Hubble is visible light, it observes invisible, and the Spitzer Infrared Telescope, which is infrared, and that telescope trails the Earth as it goes around the Sun. So we've got three different telescopes right now that are able to combine their views and give us just an extraordinary view of objects in space. Well, the more you look at stars and the more you look at planets, the better you're going to get at identifying things in the sky. I'm just going to let the sky turn just a little bit more. I want to bring up one other object. So if you are a morning riser, if you're a morning person, you won't be able to see Venus and Saturn because they will already have set down. But if you look over toward the southwest, you'll find a very bright white star, and that is the planet Jupiter. And if you look low into the southeast, you'll find a red star. Can you guess what planet that is? It is. It's the planet Mars. So we've got Mars, and actually, let me just scoot the sky just a little bit more. There's one other planet. It's one of the most difficult planets to see. Let me see if I can bring it up for you. Here we go. And from Mars, we come right over to the east to a faint orange star. That's Mercury. So you've got three planets in the early morning sky, two planets in the evening sky, and by sunrise, you're going to find the Big Dipper very low in the northwest. The more you look at the sky, the more you're going to notice changes that happen in the sky. If you look over to the east right now, you'll see there is a big change happening. We've entered astronomical twilight, the boundary between day and night. It means the sun is very close to the eastern sky and ready to bring forth the dawn of a brand new day. So let's watch a sunrise from Cambridge. Well, with the dawn of a brand new day, I'd like to thank you very much for visiting the planetarium. I hope you enjoyed our journey through the Cambridge night sky and research that's happening in Cambridge. Hope you'll get a chance to visit some of the other events happening this week at the Cambridge Science Festival. Thanks very much, and have a great day.